This is an ABC podcast.
G'day, I'm Jonathan Green. You're listening to Lost and Found. And this week, a mind journey to Reykjavik, Iceland. It's so hot right now. Picture that country. Perhaps the first thing you see, the light. The light that lingers into the dead of those summer nights. The green glow of the aurora borealis. Perhaps you're seeing icy wilderness, snow-topped mountains, blue sea, long grasses whipping in the wind. Position yourself, top of the mountain, peer into the city of Reykjavik. Houses painted yellow, white, red and blue, arranged like little Lego rows dotted along the coastline. If you listen closely, maybe you hear music. Sniff the air, you might catch the unlikely scent of cardamom wafting from a bakery or some flowers at the Botanic Gardens. If you take the lead of A. Kendra Green, author of The Museum of Whales You Will Never See, you will end up in an assortment of Reykjavik museums.
I think Iceland has a lot of things going for it to become just a center of museums. Any place with a small population is going to tend towards extremes, but this is a place that for so long was one of the poorest nations in Europe, was sort of remote and hard to get to, and yet influenced by Basque sailors and people coming from all sorts of places, right? The Celtic and the Nordic influences. If you have a place that for a long time doesn't have the sort of traditional materials that we're used to culture being made out of, right? Not a lot of wood unless it comes from shipwreck or driftwood, basically no metal, almost no workable clay. You get a lot of cultural production funneled into storytelling. And, right, we see that in the sagas, we see it in the poetry, and eventually, I think you see it in storytelling institutions, and that's what museums are.
All right, we've got some time. Let's take a little virtual museum tour of Reykjavik. Where will we begin?
Let's go to the Saga Museum, because it is the deep, long-standing, old history of Iceland, a lot of which we know from their stories. This is a place that has these life-size tableaus cast in a really meticulous silicon method from actual Icelanders. I'm told that if you were around when they were doing it, you would maybe recognize some people in town. And of these situations, right, you see the first arrival into Iceland. You see the decision to convert to Christianity after meditating in a tent all night. And you get to meet Freydis Eriksdóttir. We only know about her from two accounts from the Vinland sagas. This is the daughter of Eric the Red and the half-sister of Leif Erikson. And we catch her in this amazing scene where her men are under attack. All of her warriors are fleeing. And she's been caught by the enemy, probably because she was pregnant at the time and maybe a little slow to catch up with her men. She has a sword that she's taken off of a dead man, and we meet her in this tableau where she has pulled down her garment to expose one breast. She's got the sword held up to it, and she threatens to cut it off. And this is so shocking, so just totally alien, that they basically decide, you know what? Never mind, right? They retreat. They leave her like it never happened. She runs after her men and berates them for abandoning her.
Well, the first people who lived here, coming from Norway, the Vikings.
Trusty Valsen, architect, urban planner, and emeritus professor of planning at the University of Iceland.
They established their farms on the coast. So in order to be able to harvest both the fruits of the land and the fruits of the sea, So they were totally integrated with the sea and the land. And that continued well into last century, actually.
So slowly but surely, Reykjavik has become an urban city. When did that process begin?
Well, it can be said to have really begun during the Second World War. We were occupied by the British and then taken over by the Americans. They are still in Keflavik Airport with a little airbase. And then the modern times rushed into Reykjavik with all this equipment, jeeps and trucks and bulldozers and everything coming from with the armies. But that brought also some bad things with it, understandably. Reykjavikians that were really so nature people before, they got so excited about all this modern equipment. And we just wanted to have skyscrapers like in these big cities, and we didn't think about the treasures that we really have in our close contact. Actually, it's the setting of Reykjavik. It's very beautiful.
Is that still a tension in Icelandic people, that idea of the natural and the urban city?
Well, we actually, at that time, we lost our footing, but we are gaining more and more interest in connecting again to nature. We built our, very many people have summer houses on the countryside, and we are trying to move away the harbors and the ugly and bad industrial sites on the coast, and to gain a contact to the water again.
I get the sense from that design around the urban development of Reykjavik was perhaps haphazard. I mean, is it a design city? Was there a unifying vision of how the capital would develop?
Actually, it started, of course, just by growing by trial and error. But we had a plan made in 1948. And then we imported all these wrong ideas about city planning, about bedroom communities, suburbs, and the zoning, actually. That is one of the main ills. We took up zoning. That means you sleep in one place, you work in one place, and go shopping in the third. And that meant a huge need to build highways within the city. And we are trying to go a little bit back from that today, trying to mix functions again. But it's hard to do.
Well, it's an interesting idea to unwind the urban development of a city. It's a thing that not many cities have managed to achieve.
It's very hard to do, but we are working on it. And it will take decades and decades to correct this.
Did the impact of the global financial crisis, 2008, how did that change the way the people of Reykjavik related to their city?
First of all, it was a huge shock. And what saved us, more or less, was that we were able to advertise the city and Iceland as an interesting tourist spot. And at that time, maybe 20 years ago, there were only about, say, 300,000 tourists. But now, last year, they were over 2 million. It's about seven times the population.
And that can't help but totally change the nature of places when that population is so overwhelming.
Yeah. For instance, the downtown area, well, people were eager to build the hotels and because the tourists really wanted to come here. And then the shops changed and all the prices went sky high. So a normal Icelander has not the money to live in the downtown area anymore. So the tourists are pushing us out to the outskirts of the city. Like in other big cities like Barcelona, it's a famous case there. The Spaniards don't have the money to live in Barcelona.
And when Icelanders come together and talk about these things, when residents of Reykjavik come together and talk about these things, what do they conclude? I mean, they want to scale this back, and yet this is the thing which gives such economic opportunity. It's a very hard balance.
Yeah, well, this discussion is just right now starting. And because of this influx of tourists, it's the biggest branch in our industry. And so many people say, we will have to open the country. But that's also dangerous to open it so widely like we did before. And so I'm one of those that say, slow down. we have other opportunities in Iceland than to build so much on tourism.
My name is Hjörtur Þorbjörnsson and I am the director of the Botanic Garden.
It's really nice here during springtime and summer, and also especially because of the light. Of course, we have like light most of the day hours and night hours right now, so it basically never gets dark up until late June, and then it starts getting dark again, and then we have some dark evenings in August again.
That constant daylight, that abundant source of light for plants, what does that do for plant growth?
Well, for many plants, it doesn't do so much, but for some species, it means that sometimes they do get a little bit larger than their European brothers and sisters. So, for example, the blue poppy, typically it gets a little bit bigger in Icelandic environment because of the daylight, and also the Ligularias, a species or a genus of Asteraceae, they also get a little bit bigger than what is known in England and Germany. It could also be the rain that we have lots of in Iceland that makes them go so big.
What any plant wants, lots of sun and lots of rain. The botanic gardens in Reykjavik are relatively young. What was the decision? What was the thinking there, the decision to begin those gardens?
Well, in the beginning, it was just few borders that were laid down by the Reykjavik's nursery. When Reykjavik took over that part of the city, they put out their nursery over there and decided to make a public park. And within that public park, they had some few borders where they put examples of common garden plants and an exhibition or examples of Icelandic plants. That was in the year 1961. So gradually these two borders that were put down in the public park became bigger, and every 10 years it actually expanded in size by twofold.
There must be some plants in Iceland that require quite an extreme winter season. That's part of their growing cycle, yes. I imagine.
Yeah. Here in Reykjavik, we do not get so much snow. We get more rain, and the temperature are quite mild during winter time. It does not deviate much from the 0 degrees, and in the summertime it rarely goes above 20 degrees. But in the winter time we do not get so much snow, so we have difficulties with the high Arctic and high mountain species. For example, Ranunculus glacialis, like a buttercup that grows just by the glaciers. And gets a lot of snow during winter time. It needs the snow cover in order to thrive.
What a tough little plant.
That is one species that I do.
Are there plant species in Iceland that are endangered?
Yes, we have. Well, aren't there everywhere? Of course, climate change has its effect. Some of these species that grow high up in the mountains, they climb the mountains and are being found. Every time they are checked up on, they go further up the mountains. And I actually think that there is one species that has not been found last 10 years. I can't remember the Latin name, but there is one species of Caryophyllaceae that has probably gone extinct because of climate change, the temperature getting warmer. And then we have some species that are in danger because of habitat loss, because of the human interaction, that we are building something or doing something in places.
I'm imagining that in the Reykjavik gardens that the trees are not a main feature.
Yeah, because we don't have so much tree in the Icelandic nature. We have some tree species growing around, and we have some few forests, but mainly it's low forest, and there has been a lot of deforestation going on last few hundred years since the settlement. So we don't have so many trees and not so many forests. So every time you have a garden, you try to build up the shelter and you try to focus on the trees, at least the first decades, and then you can do something.
All right, this museum we're going to go to next makes rather superb use of a former public toilet.
Indeed it does. I was mentioning the growing number of museums in Iceland according to Sigurdur Baldur Hafsteinsson's Excel spreadsheet on museums and private collections in Iceland. This one wasn't on the list. It's only been open since 2016 when Johnny Rotten of the Sex Pistols came to do the honors. It charts the 80s and 90s punk scene in Iceland, right? It gets us Björk and the Sugar Cubes and Sigur Rós, the comedian slash mayor slash punk rocker Jónar, all of it housed right in the center of downtown on Bankastræti in what used to be a public toilet. And the city was trying to figure out what to do with the space and had something of a competition for the best idea. And the punk rock museum moved in, right? It still has stalls and urinals, in addition to drums you can play yourself and mixtapes in the gift shop. And you know the person running it is a legitimate from the era punk, still with amazing hair and a great outfit.
Chef and food writer Rachel Allen spent summers visiting extended family in Reykjavik.
This was kind of before Reykjavik was really, really hip and cool, but it was going in that direction. So we could see every time we went back more and more restaurants and bars and, you know, interesting music scene happening and things like that. But I just loved it. I love it. And the light, I always remember, because we'd say, but it's not dark yet. We don't have to go to sleep. And yeah, this is in the summer where it doesn't get dark at all, practically. And that was always just really strange, you know, lying in bed and bright, bright, bright daylight. And it's extraordinary that light at night, it's not bright, but it's not in the slightest bit dark. You know, it is that kind of twilight for hours.
You presumably, as a child, ate your weight in Kleiner Donuts.
Yes, I did. I've got really, really lovely, happy memories of these. Well, Mum grew up on the docks in Reykjavik. And so in the mornings, it was always a, you know, a treat to go and say, pick up like a pastry down at the local bakery. But these were the one thing that were always made at home for my mum. She always remembers, she said, I don't know if they sold them in the bakeries, but she said, because they just need to be eaten, you know, straight out of the fryer. They were just always eaten at home. And my grandfather used to really, really love them. And in turn, everyone in our family loves them. So they're basically like, if you can imagine, a little donut. And these particular ones, they're not yeast leavened. So that's how they're different, I suppose, to American donuts, you know, but they're made with baking powder. And actually a bit of baking soda as well. And cardamom pods are in it. And I always grew up just loving cardamom, the spice. And of course, it makes such sense because it's a spice that's used in a lot of Italian, you know, or Italian, sorry, Icelandic, Nordic and Scandinavian baking too. And I have Norwegian roots as well. So I suppose it's not surprising that I just, anytime I can sneak cardamom into anything, I do. And so basically what you do is you mix flour in a bowl with some sugar, some baking powder and some baking soda and the ground cardamom. And the ground cardamom, it's not like you're tasting them and saying, oh my goodness, they've got cardamom in, but there's that lovely little, almost like a buttery eucalyptus, you know, back note. And then you rub butter into the dry ingredients, and then you whisk yogurt with some egg. And the yogurt, of course, it's like the lactic acid in the yogurt that gives them, the Kleiner, that lovely, soft, tender crumb. And then you mix the yogurt and the egg into the dough. But it's really easy because then you just kind of, you bring the bowl of dough together and then you just let it rest, kind of, you know, cover it and let it rest in the fridge for about 30 minutes. And then what you do is you roll the dough out into a large rectangle and you cut this into shapes, basically like into diamonds. So you cut it into long lengths and then across slightly at an angle, if you know what I mean. So rather than getting squares, you get more diamonds. And then you make a slit. So the dough is really only about 3 millimeters, you know, about less than 1/4 inch thick. And so each diamond is just that thick. So it's like a flatbread of sorts. Mm. But then you slash the center of each diamond, cut right through with a knife. And then you fold the bottom or the top corner angle through. You fold it through that hole that you've made in your shape. And so you get a little knot at one end. And that's just the traditional way to shape them. So it doesn't look like a pretzel, but it's, you know, just how it's folded through, if you kind of imagine. And then you fry them. You put them in the deep fry. So you've got your little twist. You know, that's what the kleiner is, the twist. And you put them into the deep fry, and then you take them out. And rather than, you don't put them to dry out on kitchen paper, straight out of the oil. As soon as they come out of the oil, you dust them with, or toss them in even, caster sugar or caster sugar with cinnamon, as my mum loves. So, oh, and then just eaten. Actually, do you know what? I'm going to make these tonight.
of course.
We make them every so often, and they're just hoovered up immediately. And they're just so, so delicious. My mum always remembers, you know, her parents would have them with a milky coffee, and she would always have them with a cold glass of milk. And you know how some things, it's like a freshly cooked chocolate chip cookie.
Yes.
You know, with a cold glass of milk.
Perfect.
Oh, perfect.
Rachel, thank
you. It's only 9 o'clock in the morning here, and I'm getting hungry.
Thank you so very much. What a beautiful food thought. No tour of Reykjavik Museumry would be complete without a visit to the Icelandic Phallological Museum.
Of course it wouldn't. And the Icelandic Phallological Museum claims to be the only museum in the world, probably, to collect a phallic specimen of every mammal species native to that country. And there's just so much going on here, right? This, if you think about it in the right way, it's a museum about the effects of global warming, because since the collection started, sort of as a not even as a joke, it was a gift to the man that became the curator while he was a headmaster. If you read your Shakespeare, you know about the pizzle, this dried, wizened bull's penis that you use as a whip in the country. It was a gift from one of the parents of a student. And the thing about Iceland is that everyone has so many jobs. As they say, we are so few. So, yeah, I mean, right, you work at the bank or you're a politician, but you also have your textile art and your band on the side and the novel you're writing, right? You're volunteering for the rescue crew. And so the teachers that worked at the same school spent their summers working at a whaling station where they had access for the only part of the whale you can tan into leather, the third that extends from the body when the retractor muscles have come to rest. And they were able to bring a 30-kilogram whale penis, plop it across their boss's desk. And you know how it is when people think that you like something, they keep bringing you more of it. Right, 30 years of collecting, the original location opened up in 1997. It went up to Husavik. It completed its collecting mission in 2011 with a human specimen, and it's now back in Reykjavik. They, in fact, just got a new lease on a new space. It should be three times as big as it ever was, and now with a cafe.
And hopefully a gift shop.
It used to be the gift shop. Everything was hand-carved by the curator, right, this former headmaster. They say he would carve keychains out of birch between grading papers. And it's gone. Right, it's not only a story about global warming or what it means to be an introduced species or domestic species. There's only one native land mammal in the country, the Arctic fox. It could have been a quickly completed collection, but of course it expanded. And there's not just the domestic collection and the foreign collection. There's also the folkloric collection and the artistic oddments. You can see a representation of the Beijing Olympic silver medalist Icelandic handball team, our silver boys, rendered as a trophy of its own. And you can also see the specimen of the hidden man, or what also gets translated as an Icelandic elf. To the untrained eye, it's just going to look like an empty jar, but it's properly labeled, so you'll know what it is.
The mind boggles. Kendra, thank you so, thank you so very much.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to Lost and Found, this time a journey to Reykjavik, Iceland. And for those that just turned in, we were in a penis museum. You'll have to listen back to the podcast or the ABC Listen app. You heard from A. Kendra Green, the trustee Valton, Hayato Thorbjornsson, and Rachel Allen. producers are Mira Adligillis and Lisa DeVissi. Technical production by Melissa May. I'm Jonathan Green.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listener.